So I will go out on a limb and say, yesterday was a good day in Peoria. Peoria Proud organized the local march and rally as part of a larger national People's March effort. About 170 people came together from groups such as this congregation or individuals who simply were moved and wanted to show up. Lula and FP collected donations of financial help and material help as well to serve the folks impacted by the challenge of securing a safe place to live. We called for human rights over our bodies, our health care, our voting, our education, who we are, how we are, and much more. Speakers include people from a range of concerns, including the Yanni Collective and addressing racism in Peoria. And it was cold, and the collective spirit warmed us and sustained us. And then many of us, this congregation, came along to hear with the members, some of the members of the public in the community, to share soup and connect with each other on how we can contribute to resisting fascism, to advocating for rights, to advocating for a more just and more whole world. So I want to thank Jesse Lachlan again for organizing the workshop, Finding Your Place in the Resistance, and for those who brought food, who helped set up and clean up, and who helped us be really good hosts. And I have to say, there were about 55 people total who came for the program and 7 children in the childcare, how much the childcare alone was appreciated, because one of our ways that we really need to be able to serve and be active is to say we are living our values and including everybody as much as possible to make this work as accessible as possible, because every one of us has something we can do. So often people wonder what difference one person can make, or that of a congregation or of a march, such as yesterday. There were some criticisms like, you know what, that voting thing, that election thing, that has already happened. The marching should have happened before that. And I'm going to offer that there is no limit to how often we can show up and say, these rights are our rights, and we are human beings, and we deserve to be seen and known, don't we all? That is without season, without time. And with a change in national administration, there are indeed real concerns for rights and for liberty, and even for the opportunity, the privilege of coming together. There was a lot of witnessing and sharing in the work yesterday, and it reminded me yet again of how one of our greatest powers as human beings is that of storytelling, of discovering, rediscovering, remembering, reminding, talking about those efforts of those who came before and found a way when the world was hard. The work is about admiring and learning from past actions and learning from mistakes as well. So I want to take this moment to share a few of those stories, because we do this when we talk about Dr. King, right? Well, this congregation has some of its own accounts. And in that sense, I want to go back just about 100 years. Seems like a nice round number. So in 1930, you have Reverend Clinton Lee Scott and Mary Slaughter Scott. I kind of appreciate this. They got married and went to a new ministry all in the same year. So they took up their ministry, his ministry here. This congregation was the largest Universalist congregation in the country at the time. And its advocacy of welcome and inclusion, and in the language of the time, of God's love as an openness and a presence here as an invitation to free thought and public discourse, I mean, that was magic. That went a long way to attracting people and had been doing so for some time. And the Scots arrived here in the midst of the Great Depression, Prohibition, and much social shift. So I want to say a little bit more about the Scots themselves. And if Cullen, you could show the photo. We have in our one of our hallways, we have photos of past ministers and current ministers. And so this is the photo of Clinton Lee Scott and Mary Slaughter Scott. And I would just want to, this is the one of the enduring images we have of them. But I want to offer the note that in 1930, Mary Slaughter Scott was 30 years old. She wasn't this. She was this whole other person, and he was this whole other person. Thank you, Cullen. And I would love to know what Mary's voice was like, because she grew up in Camp Hill, Alabama. And I have been to Camp Hill, Alabama. And I want to tell you that the Southern drawl there is deep and robust. And yet Mary went up to Tufts University in Massachusetts and had to navigate these East Coast Northerners, Unitarians and Universalists, to get her education to be respected as an educator. It was no small thing. And Clinton Lee Scott brought his deep perspective and his willingness to speak truth and a respect for the human capacity in religious conversation. Now, I have two short stories about the Scots in this church. Jesse talked about them. So keep in mind, in the 1920s and 1930s, how birth control was just beginning to be more public and a more public and more legal conversation. People were moving beyond attaching a moral stigma against physical intimacy for the sake of joy, and not just, you know, have the social context of holding it for reproduction. The first birth control clinics were founded in the mid-1920s. And people wanted advice on how to determine their choices and the size of their families. And the Scots founded a clinic here in Peoria that is part of our church history now. What's also certainly true is how the Depression weighed upon people. I love this idea of Clinton Lee Scott, Mary Slaughter Scott making a road trip to and from Chicago. No highways, right? My goodness. And to bring the first load of food that created the cooperative grocery in the basement of the church in downtown Peoria. And how they made that effort and started that off, and how that was in that basement for some months before finding a permanent home in another location. And there they were, the Scots inspiring the congregation to feed and care and meet people where they were. I mean, that's the essential work of every faith community. I really want to know what those conversations were like 100 years ago to say, this is what we need to do now. And how they persevered amidst the struggle to create these resources. Amidst a difficult social context, amidst real financial and economic limitations, even while the congregation was big and energetic and was so much in the ability to say yes. Now, in another moment, so some of those past efforts are not as documented as the ones that are more recent, but I want to turn to another moment, another question of doing the right thing. And matters of conscience, and in this case also legality, and national conflict. Because one of the most significant moments of that in this congregation's life came during the Vietnam era. Now, our larger denomination, Unitarian Universalism, was the publishing house, Beacon Press, was making the bold move in that era of being the publisher of the Pentagon Papers that documented how President Lyndon Johnson and his administration covertly expanded the conflict in Vietnam without informing the American people. But the biggest, most difficult challenge, it was generally, it was a national experience as well as certainly in our denomination, was the everyday conflict in congregations about the Vietnam War. Many ministers spoke against the military offensive, spoke against violence, spoke against the racial weight of the draft, bringing along people who didn't have the resources to get out. Ministers speaking for peace. Many members of our congregation disagreed or had conflicted feelings. There was also concerns about who could speak for the church and the minister's right to speak the truth as they saw it. And this was happening all over the country. And it happened here. And it happened during the ministry of the Reverend James Wilkes in 1968 into his departure, 1973-4, I think. The country and the church were already at odds about the Vietnam conflict before Reverend Wilkes arrived. But what brought to the question to a point was about draft counseling. Let me say a little bit more about draft counseling, because this is a story. I'll say some of these stories were ones that we can imagine, and some of these stories are ones that some of you lived through, and I'm going to say I'm of a generation that I did not. This is one that I'm still learning as someone here. So in the draft, all men between the ages of 18 and 26 were required to register for military service. 2.2 million young men were, in fact, drafted during the Vietnam era. And so many of them came from working class or lower income families, people who could not take so much advantage of legal ways to avoid being drafted, to enroll in college, for example, and were not so likely to receive good advice about how to be within the law and still not be drafted. And so to help young men explore their options, understand their options, you had draft counseling organized by groups such as the American Friends Service Committee. You had attorneys offering their advice as well. And it was legal as long as it's offered in a neutral, factual way, not advocating draft evasion. So Reverend Wilkes and the leaders discussed the request to host draft counseling at the church. It was an outside group wanting to use the church space, the Peoria Area Peace Committee, I believe. But there was a deep concern that the PAPC was not entirely nonviolent, that they advocated for a certain level of confrontation. And that was a lot at the core of the conflict. So one of the questions was whether granting the use of the building to a group was endorsement of that group, for example. There was communication and misinformation and fears of going against the law, and those were at the center of hours spent in meetings. All right, so sometimes the board meeting goes a little long, but I'm going to say it doesn't go to midnight. Not here, thank goodness. But this is what they were spending their time with. They were so struggling with this question. There was board discussion. There was messages in the newsletter. The minister and the people were trying to find a way and were fully, imperfectly human in the process. You had longtime members resign. You had membership drop. Leaders in the congregation eventually were able to agree that counseling could happen on Saturday afternoons, and this started in 1969. Not too long, it didn't take too long before the counseling moved to another location so it could happen on a full-time basis. And leaders also affirmed that the minister has a public voice of their own. But the conflict wounded the congregation, and that hurt contributed, I think, to the financial crisis that happened shortly afterward. And it also made the congregation very cautious about how to be a voice in the future. What is also true is how service and public action is part of the central tasks of a religious community: worship, fellowship, education, service. There is a point at which we, even being wounded and even having such a hard time with such a deep conflict, there's still places where we just can't help but want to help. And so over time, and with the smaller efforts that every religious community does, the congregation found ways to move past the lasting hurt of the Vietnam years and to serve our human concerns in public ways. And I want to offer just a couple. The congregation, if you look on the website, the congregation completed what's called the Welcoming Congregation Process, was recognized for that with the UUA, our Unitarian Universalist Association, in 2004. That is the process, the formal process of classes and conversation and a congregational vote of a congregation saying, we are actively, intentionally welcoming to folks who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, questioning, intersex, asexual. That is one of the ways that the congregation can formally affirm its commitment and be public. And it's actually the way, partially, how we can keep going with that message. It's not something we have to vote on again and again. We have done that vote. We can affirm it, and we need to kind of affirm that work, but we can continue with that, and we do going forward. I also want to note, again, related to the conversation from the real hardship and fear coming out of the conflict in the Vietnam era, one of the ways the congregation has found a way to have a voice is in 2011, it started the process of having specific issues connected to organizing groups and approved by the congregation. It's what our fall congregational meeting business is we take the proposals from the Social Impact Committee and hopefully vote them into action. Now, last fall, the congregation approved the work against the CO2 pipelines and the hazardous environmental and human impact of the CO2 pipeline efforts. Congregation approved continuing the work in racial justice with the Faith Coalition for Racial Equity that was formed in 2020 in response to George Floyd's murder at the hands of police. That racial reckoning of 2020 also led to the addition of the Black Lives Matter sign out front and an ongoing commitment to anti-racism, anti-oppression, and multiculturalism. And one of the things that's still forming as a specific goal, but we're living that in spirit, is to address homelessness in Peoria. And it's so good that we were able to bring Lula in today to be part of the efforts to speak against the ordinance that criminalizes camping on city property. Instead, how can we find compassionate and longer-lasting solutions? Don't further penalize the most marginalized among us. We know the work goes on. And simply reflecting on all of this during the weekend, we remember Dr. King, reminds us how much the work has been going for all of our human existence, and will keep going. It is our work as people, as creatures, as mortals with opinions and fears and hopes and aspirations. It is holy work. 100 years ago, they were looking at bodily autonomy, class, and the basic needs of food. Sound familiar? The 1960s and 1970s, they were wrestling with war, living into our morals, the practice of peace. Sound familiar? what we get to do, what we keep getting to do, what helps provide a certain degree, I think, of hope, or my perspective, is how sharing of these stories reminds us that we are all connected and we have so much aspiration and so much possibility within us and around us. And there's just the joy of never knowing where these connections will go and where this will take us. Over 20 years ago, I had the chance to preach at Camp Hill, Alabama, and see the beautiful church that was founded by Mary Slaughter's family, that was built, the beautiful church that exists now was built while she was a child and was full in living memory, and how that fostered her sense of community and action and sent her out into the world. I had no idea that I would be talking about Mary Slaughter Scott today when I first preached at Camp Hill over 20 years ago. I want that conversation with Clinton Lee Scott and with Mary Slaughter Scott about autonomy, about choice, about feeding the people, about economics, about freedom of thought in the world. I want that conversation with Reverend James Wilkes and with the board and the leadership of that time about what this was like to struggle and wrestle and try to protect people from harm, to try to live in peace and also try to live our values and not squash freedom of expression as well. The work goes on. I invite us to take up the practice, because it is a practice. There's no fixed stopping point in this work. I invite us to take up the work of being a voice and a presence and a beloved community. What a precious thing that we get to do together. Let us go forth. Amen.